period, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new national numbers out today show a record drop in retail sales last month. We'll talk about what the numbers tell us with a Wisconsin business professor. First, a lot of people have eagerly started planting seeds. Farmers market season is beginning in many places with some added precautions. And meat processing plants are experiencing a lot of turmoil. Just might be a good time to refresh our vegetarian-friendly cooking skills. And leaving out the meat doesn't have to mean leaving out the flavor, the satisfaction, or the nutrients. Aaron Alderson is a cookbook author, vegetarian recipe developer, and founder of the vegetarian cooking website, NaturallyElla.com. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, Aaron, have you noticed any changes in the kinds of recipes that people are looking for, or even that you're looking for in this unusual time?
I've noticed a lot of people are really digging into their pantry more, which results in searches and questions about grains and legumes. And so I think that people are trying to focus more inward in what they already have, which is kind of great to see.
There's an old stereotype about vegetarian cooking that I think is waning, but it's probably still out there. The idea that it's not going to be satisfying. It's not going to fill us up. And when I look at the recipes you have online, on Instagram, and on your website, I look at the pictures and the descriptions, and I think, hearty. These are hearty dishes, many of them you're cooking. Can you talk about how that might go against what people think about vegetarian cooking?
Yes, I hear that quite a bit. And it's funny because both of my husband and I are from Illinois. And so we grew up in good Midwestern cuisine. And he had a hard time transitioning for the most part, but he really, as he got more into eating vegetarian dishes, he was like, wow, I don't miss the meat, because I'm really big on using components. So making sure I have loaded with vegetables, lots of grains, again, lots of legumes, heavy use of nuts, making sure that things I do are big on flavor, because I think sometimes if things don't have a lot of flavor, we tend to eat more or feel like we need more. And really honing in on what I can get a hold of seasonally, I think helps as well.
You mentioned beans. Let's get into one of the recipes you shared with us. And we've got this online at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's a soup. This looks really good. Carrot white bean soup with herbs. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yes. So I have been on my Instagram sharing lots of bean content, but one of the things I'm a big proponent of is batch making beans. And so this soup comes from white beans that I usually keep on hand weekly. I use the broth from the beans to help flavor the soup. And I am obsessed with carrots. I think that it's a lot of people like, oh, carrots, you know, what can I do with them? So much. And so this soup brings my love of the beans together, the love of the carrots, and then I finish it off with a lot of herbs and a little bit of miso to help round everything out.
What kind of herbs end up in here?
I really love a mix of dill and parsley. I think that dill to me is one of those quintessential spring herbs, because it doesn't really last during summer, especially where I am now in California. Dill tends to wane when it gets hotter. And so I just feel that the dill works really well with a lot of the seasonal produce in spring. And so that's why I'm pretty heavy handed with it in this soup.
And you mentioned being flexible with what we have in our pantry right about now. And when you write about beans on your website, you say, you know, first choice, cook the dry beans, have batches of them ready to rock. But if you got a can of beans, you'll use a can of beans.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think that there sometimes gets to be this stigma where it's like, oh, I have to be exact. Or I am totally a proponent of use what you have. And especially, you know, nowadays, people aren't going to the grocery store as often as I would assume they are. I mean, I used to go probably every other day, and now it's a week to bi-weekly trip. And so I'm constantly digging through my pantry and saying, well, could I use this? Can I change it up? And normally the answer is yes.
Speaking of shopping, how have you changed the way you shop, given that you're trying to do things in, you know, one trip instead of every other day trips?
It has definitely been a change for me, because like I said, I'm used to going every other day, every 3 days. And so it's forced me to really think ahead and again, think about, okay, well, I have this produce on hand. What do I think I might need? And I still inevitably weekly come home and I realize, oh, I forgot this, but we learn to live without.
talking to Erin Alderson. You can find a lot of her recipes on the vegetarian cooking website, naturallyella.com. She's talking about making great vegetarian meals, entrees, soups, and more, even if you're not a vegetarian yourself. And Erin, I understand you actually transitioned. You haven't always been a vegetarian yourself. What was it like for you making the shift toward more and more vegetables and then mainly just vegetarian?
It was tough at first, primarily because that was also when I was really starting to learn to cook. And so I wasn't sure what I was doing in both respects. But as I got more confident in my cooking abilities and matching flavors and really experimenting, I realized that there's so much fun to be had with using the ingredients in the realm of the vegetarian world. And so eventually, once I got comfortable with that, I don't miss it at all, because I think that there's so much, again, so much fun to be had.
It's clear to me you're a fan of humble ingredients, and I don't think there's anything more humble than a turnip. And that's another recipe you've shared with us. You've got these pan-fried turnips with thyme and breadcrumbs. I don't think I've ever eaten turnips made this way. I like a good turnip. Talk about this recipe, and like you end up with breadcrumbs and get a little crust on these guys?
A little bit, yes. So these actually use one of my favorite cooler weather varietals, which is the Hakurei turnips, which is a Japanese varietal of turnips. So it's not those bigger turnips we're used to seeing. They're smaller, they're white, they're about the size of a golf ball. With their greens, you can eat the whole thing, and they're a little bit more mellow. So if someone thinks, oh, I really do not like turnips, because they can be a little bit aggressive, these turnips, a little bit more mellow, and I think that they're just wonderful in salads by themselves, or this is one of my favorite sides, just pan fried lightly, little herbs. And yeah, it's perfect for me.
Well, now sometimes I'm at the grocery store and their turnip selection is limited to the one kind of turnip. Can I make this dish with the, you know, standard issue turnip variety? You know, I'll get more of that turnip flavor, but is it going to come out okay?
It will. It'll still come out okay.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, what else do you like to do with those roots that people don't necessarily? I mean, carrots and potatoes we eat a lot. The turnips, the rutabagas. I love parsnips. What kind of things do you like to do with those?
I tend to roast a lot of them, but I also find, I think I have another recipe for turnips in particular, where I pan fry them with a soy sauce based sauce and turn it into almost like a fried rice dish with some rice. And the turnip flavor is just perfect enough with the soy sauce mix that it all comes together great.
What kind of seasonal ingredients are you excited about when springtime rolls around?
Oh, everything. I get really excited about, I mean, the normals, asparagus, strawberries, lots of greens. I feel like, I mean, we get greens out here during the winter, but for whatever reason, in springtime, I get even more excited about those greens. And so the arugula, the spinach, especially because we have kind of a short spring season. It's already been getting up into the 90s out here. So I really like to hone in on eating as many of those fresh greens as I can.
We're talking to Erin Alderson from the website Naturally Ella. She's the author of several cookbooks and a vegetarian recipe developer and educator. She's sharing some recipes and suggestions with us on Food Friday. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a vegetarian or not, do you have some favorite meatless friendly meals? If you're not vegetarian, do you try to include some meatless meals in your mix? Do you have questions about how to make certain things for Erin? And are there favorite ingredients that you love to have, vegetable ingredients, the tofus and things like that of the world that you like to mix into your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a few recipes from Erin. These look good. They're at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Alderson. She has a popular vegetarian cooking website and Instagram called Naturally Ella. She's sharing some great meat-free cooking ideas today, advice and recipes. And you could join in this week's Food Friday at 800-642-1234. Have you made the move to a more plant-focused diet, whether it's full veggie or not? What are some of your favorite meals without meat? Do you have questions about using up a certain kind of vegetable? Do you have something that you look forward to any given time of year, like springtime, say? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few recipes from Aaron over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Before we go to our callers, Aaron, I want to check out one more recipe you've shared with us. And I'm here in Wisconsin. I'm going to admit some cheese ignorance. We've got an herby kale omelet with Manchego cheese. I had to look this up. It's a cheese of La Mancha in Spain. Tell us about this omelet.
So the omelet itself is pretty straightforward, except that I make a kale sauce. And I will be the first to admit, I don't normally like all cooked greens. I'm very particular about that, but I really love them in sauce, especially this one, because it's paired with a lot of herbs. Again, you'll notice I'm kind of big on the herbs. And sure, this one has tarragon, which I feel like doesn't get used often enough, primarily probably because people are a little nervous about that licorice flavor. But I feel like it's really nice when paired with the kale and the parsley. And then the Manchego cheese has enough flavor to balance that kind of herb punch that I feel like it just comes together in the omelet.
And it's a sheep milk cheese. If I can't find that particular one, are there other sheep milk cheeses I could sub in there?
Honestly, I feel like I am, when it comes to putting cheese in an omelet, not most picky person. I do love my cheeses. So really anything that'll give a good melt is a good substitute.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Rhiannon in Clyman is on the air. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to bring up?
So I have a fantastic recipe. It's my go-to eggless egg salad with tofu. And I love how your guest is talking about punches of flavor and just making it a very robust and umami type of food, because vegetarian and vegan can end up being a little bit flat if you don't flavor it right. So the secret that I found with eggless egg salad is replacing the eggs with tofu, but ensuring you press it well enough. And to get that sulfury little bit of egg undertone is adding black salt. It gives that just little bit of sulfur flavor.
Ooh, interesting. Wow, that's a well-thought-out tofu egg-style salad. What do you think, Aaron?
I think that sounds amazing with the black salt. That sounds perfect.
I've never tried black salt before. My salt experimentation has been limited. Is that something you play with, different kinds of salts in your cooking to add different textures and flavors?
Not as much as I should. I have a little bit, but I feel like I need to go order some black salt now.
Yeah, I kind of want to, too. And before we go back to our callers, thanks a lot for that call, by the way. You're talking about the herbs. I got to say, back in the old days, I used to, you know, if I'd have a fresh herb or sometimes even dried herbs, I'd like sprinkle a little teaspoonful in and, you know, you don't even notice that it's there. And one thing I've learned from doing these Food Fridays over the years is to go big and bold with flavors. And it really, like using cilantro, like, you know, an ingredient, not a seasoning.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of territory we're talking about, like handfuls instead of pinches?
Yes. And I think I learned this a lot when I've been reading a lot of different cultural cookbooks, and Middle Eastern cuisine really, I feel like is wonderful with this, because you just see salads that are half herbs and it's really inspiring, because I feel like, yeah, I was the same for a long time where I was like, oh, I'll just use a little, but herbs are meant to be used and used boldly, I feel. And so I've been really inspired by reading some different cookbooks.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dawn is with us in South Milwaukee. Dawn, hello.
Hi there. How are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Dawn?
I just wanted to make a comment that I'm a real fan of the root vegetables, but there's not much out there that I find in cookbooks about how to cook them in different ways. And I'd like to enjoy them all year long. And I was just wondering if you could give any guidance about some different ideas on how to cook them.
Well, Dawn, I got to ask, do you oven roast your root vegetables, the parsnips or even carrots or for that matter?
Well, I'm just new at learning at cooking right now. I've just kind of started cooking, and I've done a lot of sauteing, and I've done some pureeing, but I have not done the oven roasting yet. I haven't started with that.
Dawn, thank you so much. I was where you were not that long ago, and oven roasting root vegetables really just added so much. Do you have advice on oven roasting for her and anybody else who's interested, Erin?
Yes. One of my things is that I feel like people are scared to overcook vegetables. But when it comes to roasting, especially root vegetables, I feel like there needs to be a little bit more aggressiveness, because yeah. I'd rather have a root vegetable that's nice and tender, golden on the outside, than one that's undercooked. So I recommend, if you're starting to feel a little nervous, leave it in for a little bit longer and just keep checking, because I feel like root vegetables really want that really nice cooking.
And I'm just cutting stuff up, tossing it in oil, and then throwing it in the oven. And the one thing I've kind of learned over the years from people is, you know, don't just throw it in at 350. You're cranking it to like 425. Some people go even higher. Do you like a good hot oven for your root vegetables?
I do. I'm a 425 person.
Okay. That's kind of where I'd settled, actually. So that's, I'm glad I'm in the right place. Thank you so much for that call. I hope that helps. Give it a try. Oven roasted root vegetables are awesome, and it's kind of hard to screw up too badly, I think. Let's go to another caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Nick on the line now in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Oh, geez, here we go. I'm going to get yelled at. I have a question for you. I'm a bad diabetic. I don't even pay attention to my blood sugar, which is really bad. And it seems like everything that's really good for you doesn't taste very good, and everything that's really bad for you tastes really good. Any suggestions on how to get over this little dilemma?
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Now, neither of us, or I'm not a nutritionist. I don't think you are either, Erin. But can you talk about just some good, basic, healthy tasting food that's going to get Nick started? Maybe, I don't know, going back to the bean family, I believe is pretty diabetic friendly.
Yes, I am also not a nutritionist, but I know when it comes to flavors, it's going to go back to, I feel like my repeating theme on today's show is flavor is really your friend, and experimenting, no matter what you're cooking with, a lot of spices, really dig into that spice cupboard that you might have, a lot of herbs, a lot of garlic and onions. And I feel like you start to add more of that in, and you can really build a flavor base that can hopefully help you transition a little bit to eating something a little healthier.
Okay. While you were talking, I did some extensive research. The American Diabetes Association advises people with diabetes to add dried beans or no sodium canned beans to several meals each week. So seek ye the beans, add some, chili powder or something to it, and work up from there maybe. That's a good, I hope you can be a better diabetic. Good luck to you. We are talking about vegetarian cooking on Food Friday. Erin Alderson is with us. Her website is Naturally Ella. She's got an Instagram too. We've got some of her recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to another caller now. John is with us, calling from Delafield. John, hello.
Well, hello. I'm a lifelong carnivore trying to move more to vegetarian. And so I'm curious what Erin thinks about my favorite food, a burger, but these synthetic burgers like Beyond Meat, Impossible Meat, whatever they're called, and whether she has any ideas to improve upon that concept of sort of a meatless hamburger, because what I've tasted, I haven't been terribly impressed with.
John, thanks a lot for the call. I think a lot of people in John's boat, Erin.
Yes. So I think that the meatless options out there, it's great to see an increase in the amount of options for vegetarian and vegans nowadays, but I tend to stick with homemade versions of these because I just like to know what's going into them. And what I found across the board, whether I'm using something from the freezer section or one of these new items, is that I still treat it as though I'm cooking a regular burger, and I make sure I layer it with all the sauces and dress it up with some grilled onions. And because sometimes I feel like, especially transitioning into something like this, it can be a little off-putting if your brain thinks it's going to be one thing. So setting realistic expectations, knowing it's going to be different, but still dressing it up like your favorite burger.
All right. Hope that helps. We have a lot of good walnut burgers, I'll say, here in Wisconsin that are also excellent vehicles for condiments. They're crunchy, though, not like a real hamburger. I didn't see it on your website, but I didn't dig all the way through, Erin. Have you experimented with making your own, patty-like substances that you might serve on a bun with awesome condiments?
I do. I actually have a nut burger that I have been working on for years to perfect, and it's one of my favorite. It doesn't grill, but you pan fry it in a little bit of oil. So yeah, it's kind of exactly what you were just saying about the walnut version, is that it gets crisp on the outside, but it stays together, and it just has really nice flavor. So again, it's not meat. It's not going to taste like meat, but it's its own thing, and I think that's wonderful.
Let's bring on one more caller. Karen is with us in Cuba City. Karen, hello.
Hi. Okay, so I'm hoping you guys can disabuse me of the idea that I've hallucinated this. A couple of weeks ago, I swear I saw a recipe online using hasta, as they were very, very tightly furled up, and it said you could use them just like you do asparagus or fiddlehooks, but they have to be tightly furled. And we have a wonderful greenhouse near here, and they have thousands of different hostas. And I went over and talked to the guy there, and he'd never heard of it. But I swear I saw this.
All right. I'm looking online. It says hostas are supposedly edible for humans. However, dogs, cats, and horses should not eat them. Have you? I have never even heard of this. Aaron, have you ever heard of cooking with hostas?
I have to say I was frantically Googling just now because I had not heard of that. But I feel like that's one of those things. I am not a forager. I have much respect for people who are really good at that. But I just saw that one of the people that I admire about foraging says about cooking and eating hostas. So again, now something I have to add to my list to go check out.
All right, and she mentioned in our last few moments, Aaron, she did mention asparagus there, your favorite way to cook and then eat asparagus, please.
I like to shave it and add it to pasta at the very end because I don't like overcooked asparagus. And so the shaved pasta or the shaved asparagus keeps a little bit of the crunchy texture, but you still get that great spring asparagus flavor.
Fantastic. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Rob, for having me.
That's Aaron Alderson, creator of the Naturally Ella Vegetarian Cooking website and Instagram. You can find more about her and her recipes at naturallyella.com. We've got recipes she shared for herby kale omelet, the carrot white bean soup, and the pan-fried turnips up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up after the news, clothing was the biggest loser in a bad month of retail sales in April. We'll check out a new report and what it'll take for retail businesses to survive. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to a Wisconsin researcher about why people with asthma and respiratory allergies could possibly have less severe symptoms if they contract COVID-19. First, retail sales dropped a lot last month. According to data released today by the U.S. Census Bureau, sales dropped over 16% from March to April. Clothing retailers took the biggest hit, falling almost 79% from March. The coronavirus pandemic and stay-at-home orders were clearly a big part of that story. Hart Posen is professor of management and human resources at UW-Madison School of Business. Hart, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, I think everybody expected to see bad news for retail. How bad was this news in this report?
Well, it's obviously very, very bad. You know, the numbers are basically all negative across most retail sectors. Some as high as almost an 80% drop for clothing and accessory retailers.
And March had already seen the previous record drop at more than 8% over February. And then, of course, we've got now stay-at-home orders coming in and out. And we've talked in the past, Hart, about how difficult it was for some retailers already. Are you expecting to see a lot of people, small and big, end up out of business after all of this?
Absolutely. You know, there are two kinds of things going on. There were the weak retailers to start with. So these were the Sears, the Kmarts, JCPenney's, and this will accelerate their demise. And in some respects, that will be good for the retailers that survive. Now, there are other retailers who were doing, reasonably well to extremely well, and whether that is a Walmart, a Target, or even to some extent, Kohl's locally, they are going to be hit by this. But I think in the end, if they survive, and they will, I believe, all of those, they're going to be in a stronger position when this is over.
Now, the clothing sector is the one you mentioned, around 80% drops. That's the one. Clothing took a big hit, which makes sense. They didn't get to stay open as essential businesses in many places. Is this a thing where, hey, if they weather the storm long enough, the customers are going to come back and turn things around, and the sales they missed over 2 months, they're going to pick up 2 months after they're able to open at full force?
I don't think we have much good data on that, but I ultimately doubt that they'll recover the losses in these months. I think the best we can hope for is that once these stay-at-home orders start to be pulled back, that they'll start to go return towards their prior sales levels. But, lots of those folks were in trouble to start with. Whether it is the department stores like Neiman Marcus, or whether it's mall-based clothing retailers like The Gap, it's been a very, very tough slog, and you and I have talked about some of this with Forever 21 a few months ago.
And then there's the question of consumer psychology. Even when stores can legally open, are we, the public, going to be in a hurry to go back to them? We don't have a lot of precedent on this, I'm pretty sure, Hart, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think this is going to be particularly tough for clothing retailers because, one of the reasons for going to a clothing retailer is to see, touch, to feel, and to try on. And, of course, that's not going to be the same for some time, even when these places reopen. And I think that, that raises the question for some of these folks of how to continue integrating their online presence with their fixed retail store presence and how to make that work better. And some folks have done a very good job of it, but clearly others have not.
Talking to Hart Posen from UW-Madison School of Business, looking at a new report showing a big drop in retail sales in April in the United States after a pretty big drop the month before that, too, and what the retail market could look like in the future. Now, with that online, Hart, and this is a question I've asked a few different people, a lot of people who are not the traditional online purchasers maybe getting into buying things online. That was the one sector where we did see sales go up, actually, in this difficult month for retail. Do you see consumers who maybe turned online for the first time to buy stuff staying there when we're back to whatever normal looks like?
Well, that's awfully hard to predict. I think it will vary by sector. Grocery online retail, which has really been around since the late 1990s, but never substantially took off, is obviously going to be fundamentally changed. A lot more people are going to be comfortable buying groceries online and either having them delivered or picking them up in a drive-through manner at the retail store. So I think there'll be substantial and persistent changes there. I'm not a pessimist about in-store retail. I think ultimately people want to go to stores. They want to go shopping because it's part of the way we interact with other people. It's a social kind of activity often. So I believe that those things will in fact come back to some extent, although it may never be quite the same.
One concern I've seen out there, Hart, is that some of the big successful businesses you mentioned in retail are going to stick around, but that small businesses are going to be hit particularly hard by this. We're going to lose a large proportion of them. Concerns about larger businesses finding it easier to get the Paycheck Protection Program, helping them stay afloat. Smaller businesses are having a hard time. Do you worry that we're going to lose that small retail mix?
Well, first of all, the Paycheck Protection Program and the way that was administered, it's in some way a tragedy for small business, right? There's no doubt about that. At the same time, I'm clearly there are going to be many small retailers that are going to go out of business, and that's going to hurt, you know, certain areas and clearly lots of people. I also think we've seen a lot of small retailers find unique and novel ways to deal with this, with curbside pickup and other things. And the other part is I think we've come to realize how much we value those kinds of retail experiences. And so, yes, it clearly a lot of small local retailers are going to be hurt. But I do think that it is not all lost. And I think for some of them, they're going to find real opportunity and new ways of doing business that they never quite imagined.
Yeah. Can you talk about what you've seen in terms of innovation? I've done, you know, with some of my favorite small businesses. They've made a hybrid. You order the thing online, pick it up at the door or on the curb, or you call. They've been winging it in many ways. But do you think that some good will come out of that in the future?
I absolutely do. You know, I've been shopping myself at local retailers who would never have, you know, taken an order and then brought it out to your car when you showed up. And I think that people are finding new and interesting ways to do things. You also see it in the restaurant sector, right? You know, a lot of small local restaurants might have had takeout business. They might have worked with DoorDash or one of the other players. But ultimately, they weren't well set up to do that efficiently. And I think this has been an opportunity for many of them to figure out how to do these things that they always sort of thought of as secondary, to do them way better. And in the long run, some of those small retailers are really going to see new profits coming out of their new ways of relating to and working with their customers.
What are you going to be watching for, Hart, in the coming couple months to see what kind of retailers can survive and hopefully thrive after all of this?
You know, I do think we're going to be watching for, you know, particularly when customers feel comfortable going back into malls. We know malls had been declining for some time, but we've also seen even in local malls in Madison here, we've seen the mall owners changing the mix of the types of shopping experiences in those malls. And I think the question is, when will people feel ready to come back? And I don't think we have any good idea of when that will be. And I think the other part is not only come back, but when are they going to feel comfortable browsing, you know, touching the merchandise in the store, looking at that sweater, picking up that bowl? When's that going to happen? And I think everyone's keeping a close eye on that as we get closer in Wisconsin and elsewhere to reopening retail stores in one way or another.
Hart, thanks again for joining us today.
Rob, I hope next time we can do it in the studio again.
Yeah, it's always more fun that way, hopefully soon. That's Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at UW-Madison School of Business. We talked to him today about the big drop in retail sales in a new report looking at April. Coming up, we'll look at research here in Wisconsin that looks at people with asthma and allergies and how they are impacted by COVID-19. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A team of doctors from around the country, including UW-Madison, say they've come up with a treatment for COVID-19 that reduces the need for ventilators and ultimately save lives. Coming up, we'll talk with one of those doctors about how it works and why it isn't being more widely used. Now, COVID-19 is a disease that can cause severe respiratory symptoms, so it would seem to make sense that people with asthma or respiratory allergies would be more susceptible. But preliminary research out of the UW-Madison seems to indicate that the opposite might be true. Dr. Daniel Jackson is an associate professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's the lead investigator on a study of COVID-19 in people with asthma and respiratory allergies. Dr. Jackson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you start us off by describing a little bit the effect that COVID-19 has on our respiratory system, our breathing system?
Yeah, so COVID-19 as a respiratory virus can cause a severe viral pneumonia, which for patients who develop that severe illness can lead to respiratory failure where they need to have mechanical ventilation in order to support their breathing and ultimately that can be one of the reasons that people can die from COVID-19.
So I would have gone in assuming that people with different kinds of asthma might be more vulnerable. They already are vulnerable to respiratory risks. What did you go into this research trying to find out?
So when we saw the initial reports coming out of China, one of the things that a lot of asthma specialists noted was the absence of asthma as a major risk factor for severe COVID-19 in China. And this really surprised us, just like you said, given the fact that patients with allergies and allergic asthma tend to have more trouble with respiratory viruses. And in fact, for example, with the H1N1 flu pandemic in 2009, asthma was a major risk factor for severe disease with H1N1. So we wanted to understand why we weren't seeing asthma and allergies being such an important risk factor for COVID-19 in those early studies.
And before digging more into your research, even in like normal-ish times, things like pneumonia and things like that, that would be a bigger concern for someone with asthma than for everybody else. Do I have that right?
Absolutely correct. So people with asthma tend to have greater risk of a variety of different infections, both respiratory and bacterial infections, leading to pneumonia. So right on target this was a surprise to see.
And talk about asthma a little bit. There are a couple different kinds of asthma. Can you spell those out for us?
Yeah, so I'm a pediatrician, and in children, allergic asthma is really the most common type of asthma, meaning that children have underlying allergies, and that is a component of their asthma. And in that case, most often bad asthma flares are triggered by infections with respiratory viruses. There are also people that have non-allergic asthma. That tends to be a little bit more common in adults. But those patients still often have significant difficulty with respiratory viruses and can lead to flares of their disease.
Okay, so here we are with your research now. What kind of things have we learned about asthma and its relationship to COVID-19 severity, and how do we try to figure out why those connections you found are there?
Yeah, so, ultimately, as I said, the data from China suggested that asthma wasn't a major risk factor for severe COVID-19. Early data from New York also has suggested the same. It may not be that asthma is protective, but it doesn't seem to increase your risk like we would have anticipated. So we decided to look at components of asthma and see whether there were particular components that might impact your susceptibility to SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. And what we saw was that the receptor for this virus, so that's what allows the virus to get into cells and infect the person, that for a lot of the bad risk factors like obesity and cardiovascular disease and hypertension, that receptor tended to be increased in patients that had greater risk of COVID-19. So we wanted to look to see if perhaps allergy and or allergic asthma could be associated with a reduction in that receptor as a reason why you might be a little less susceptible. And what we found was that indeed allergy in particular, so respiratory allergy, meaning being allergic to environmental things like dogs or cats or pollens, was associated with reduced expression of that receptor for the COVID-19 virus. And that furthermore, if we expose someone to an allergen, these were prior studies that we had done, that receptor expression was reduced even further. So we thought this was a really intriguing finding that could provide some suggestion of a reason why allergy and asthma weren't increasing our risk like we expected it to.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Jackson at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about asthma, allergic asthma, and risk of severe COVID-19 symptoms. Dr. Jackson, just to make clear, this doesn't mean somebody with allergic asthma should think of themselves as invulnerable to COVID-19, right? This is not a free pass.
It is not a free pass at all. It's very important that patients with asthma follow their asthma action plans that their providers have given them. This is a time of year when asthma tends to be triggered by environmental allergies and other things. We want to make sure that we're still controlling their asthma. But it may provide a little bit of reassurance for people that have had a lot of fear about asthma being a major risk factor for this disease. But I would say the jury's still out. We need to see a lot more information on these relationships over time.
Right. And that leads to my next question. What are you looking at next, Dr. Jackson, when it comes to asthma and COVID-19?
So about 2 weeks ago, we actually started a study that's being funded by the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease called the HEROES study, that's looking at children and their families and how the SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 virus infects children and their parents and siblings, and the risk factors for both infection but also for severe illness. And we think this information is going to be particularly helpful as we start to think about how we may be able to move forward in terms of opening schools in the future and all those kinds of things. But we'll also be looking at these specific risk factors like underlying respiratory allergy and asthma in these populations to see whether it truly impacts both the risk of infection but also the risk of severe COVID-19.
Now, with this idea that allergic asthma may make these receptors you're talking about, in effect, less friendly landing sites for the virus that causes the COVID-19 illness, are there thoughts that this might lead to treatment, to efforts to prevent people from catching the illness in the first place?
So I think it is important to think about how allergy or the allergic type response might be impacting susceptibility. We really need these further results of studies showing whether it's truly making a difference in both risk of infection and risk of severe disease. But if it is, then it would suggest that perhaps this immune response, which oftentimes is problematic with other respiratory viruses, may actually not be a bad thing with regards to COVID-19.
Now, looking at, again, people with allergic asthma and their risk of severe COVID-19 complications, is it across the board? Does it vary by age? Are there subgroups within this based on the data you have at hand?
So most of the data that we have is in children. And fortunately, children are actually much less susceptible to severe COVID-19 illness than adults and particularly older adults. So I don't think we can kind of take this across the board to talk about older adults with allergic asthma, since it wasn't part of the studies that we participated in. But, you know, ultimately, across the board, no matter what your risk is, it's really important that we continue to take precautions with regard to our exposures to the virus, with good hand washing, social distancing, and all of those things to maintain safety for all.
This is asthma we're talking about in particular. Are there other respiratory conditions where we know people are at a higher risk of COVID-19 complications?
So the data has been a bit mixed on that. So chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in some, or COPD, in some studies has looked like a significant risk factor. It's always a little bit hard to disentangle those risk factors in these epidemiological studies, just because a lot of patients with COPD, have smoked or continue to smoke. They also could be overweight, have hypertension, or other things that have been identified as risk factors. So in general, we haven't identified COPD by itself as a major risk factor, but a lot of times those patients, because of a variety of comorbidities, may have more severe disease.
In our last few moments, Dr. Jackson, obviously asthma is always critical research and has life or death implications for people. But do you feel an even greater urgency now to look at respiratory conditions amidst this COVID-19 outbreak?
Yeah, we always have been very focused on asthma. As you said, it's a major cause of morbidity and unfortunately still mortality within our country and around the world. It disproportionately affects urban populations and minority populations, who also seem to be much more severely affected by COVID-19. So, I think it does, highlight the importance of respiratory disease. COVID-19 has shed great light on that, and we'll continue to work to hopefully lessen that disease severity over time.
Dr. Jackson, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Daniel Jackson is an associate professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's the lead investigator on this study we've been talking about, looking at COVID-19 in people who already have asthma and respiratory allergies. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we're going to talk about great live music albums and videos that can hopefully tide us over until we can see live performances in person again. And today in the news, I see there's a non-live album that's still finding new life more than four decades after it was released. An alert music writer at the Forbes website noticed something in the latest Billboard Top 200 album charts, tucked way down at number 193, not the most prominent spot. But the album that entered the chart or re-entered it at number 193 was Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, released in 1973. According to the Forbes article, this marks the 950th week that Dark Side of the Moon has appeared in the top 200, having bounced on and off again over the many years. That is a record by a long shot, a really long shot. 950 weeks for Dark Side of the Moon. In second place, 625 appearances for Legend, the Bob Marley compilation album. I suspect the longevity of both those albums comes from new generations of high school and college students discovering them for the first time, some cases getting the cool Prism poster from the Dark Side of the Moon album. Plus, people have probably rebought them for in vinyl, cassette, 8-track, laserdisc, digital downloads, and more. Contemplate these long-lasting albums and breathe in the air. This is Central Time.